Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm studying the myths and religions of the world and looking for inspiration in them for fantasy role-playing games. Today's episode is the conclusion of our season on Haitian voodoo. We've looked at the historical and cultural context of voodoo. We've looked at many of the loi, or spirits, or gods, who are at the center of voodoo belief, and we've looked at many of voodoo's religious and magical practices. And here we are. We have come to the end of this season. Obviously, we haven't come to the end of things that one can know or learn about Haitian voodoo. Like with most seasons, we've only scratched the surface. Typically in these season finale episodes, I talk about things I haven't covered, and then I offer some final thoughts. So let's start with things I haven't covered. I think the main thing that I didn't cover was twins. So I don't know if I've even talked about the Marasa or Marasa Jumeau, the divine twins, at all. I think they get overlooked because they don't have the kind of colorful personality that you get from loi like Legba or Bon Samedi or Oga. You know what I mean? Like, they're not as memorable characters, but they're quite important to voodoo ceremony. They are contacted right after Papa Legba, as a rule, and this respect for these twin loi extends to actual twins. Like, twins are seen as special. It's something that Metro talks about a lot, the idea that twins receive certain, like, privileges, but are also seen as more difficult or demanding. There's a recurring image where twins are in some ways presented with the number three. So, for example, the veve of the Marasa is very clearly in three parts, not two like you would expect. And some of the rituals that involve twins have this bowl that's like divided into three parts. And I've seen this interpreted in multiple ways, but I like the idea that it represents a third entity, or like sometimes that third entity is the child that's born after the twins, but sometimes it's the twins as a unit. So like there's one twin, and then there's the other twin, and then there's a third thing, which is both twins. I think this is pretty understandable, right? I mean, twins fascinate us. All kinds of doubles and doppelgangers in many ways are about the idea of seeing ourselves in somebody else. And of course, a twin is somebody else in whom it is easy to see yourself. The similarity between twins, you know, maybe it's genetic, maybe it's to do with the way that, you know, if you are born in the same household at the same time, then you might have very similar experiences. We feel very close to them, and yet we're also in some ways estranged, partly because of that similarity. This is true of siblings in general. I don't even mean twins specifically. Like, there are times when I look at my brother and I see things that, like, I would do, jokes that I would make. I see him finding things difficult that I find difficult. But then there are also many ways in which we contrast. We're very different. You know, we're alike, but not alike. And that, to some extent, has been true throughout adulthood, but it was also true when we were children, even though we grew up in the same time at the same place and not that far apart. We're less than 2 years difference in our age. So we're alike, but not alike. And we're not twins, just regular old brothers. I read that this belief in the sacred nature of twins exists in a lot of the West African spiritual traditions from which voodoo is derived. Interestingly, the Yoruba people, according to this article, have the highest birth rate of twins in the world. I genuinely never thought that it would be different from one place to another, and it's also nice to know that it is somebody's job to keep track of that. Mind you, that is assuming that it is true. Again, few role-playing games pay attention to this kind of thing. The Palladium games, for instance, had you rolling for birth order. There was a lot of detail about like where in your family your character was, but I doubt it ever really came up very much. And I'm playing in this RuneQuest game, and of course RuneQuest in many ways can be like focused in the community and care a lot about your relations and whatever. But there does come a time where after a party of five player characters have all created all their various brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles, and you start to think, you know, realistically, I don't know that all of these characters are going to come up. I don't think I've ever played a character who was another character's twin. I actually don't remember. I played a brother and sister team. In fact, they weren't brother and sister. He was an imposter, but he eventually came to feel like the brother, and then I was waiting for an opportunity to heroically sacrifice myself to save my sister, but it never came. But they weren't twins. Anyway, another thing that really struck me this season, and like, I can't say that I didn't cover this because this is more like an absence, but I mentioned this last time, this idea about Haitian voodoo not having that much in the way of a body of mythology. Like, it has these characters, but they are characters that it's almost like those characters are, I guess this is another metaphor that I haven't really talked about very much, but the idea of role-playing. You know, that being ridden by Loa is in essence, I mean, assuming that we're going to take a non-supernatural explanation for the phenomenon, it's obviously a form of role-playing. The person is embodying in their behavior the character of the Loa. And so in some ways, the Loa feel like characters ready for play, in a sense. So they have personalities and they have likes and dislikes, but they don't have a very long and detailed history, because what's important is how they are going to interact with you in the future, and because of the way that Haitian voodoo works, they are going to do that, right? You're never going to meet Thor, but you can absolutely meet Oga. He's around. Like, when we did the Hawaiian season, there was a lot of mythology, often in poetic form, and there's much less of that in Haitian voodoo. Not none, but I think it's a big part of the emphasis that this spiritual practice places on personal experience. Speaking of personal experience, another thing that I think I could have talked about more is the role of landscape in voodoo. You know, there's quite a lot of voodoo symbolism or voodoo connection in, like, the Haitian landscape. There's a complex symbolism of trees, for instance. Like, I mentioned that, but I couldn't really find a lot of good information on it. But particular trees are regarded as sacred to particular Loa. And just feel like there's a lot more nature stuff that I really didn't get into. And that could also connect the idea that, you know, even though Haiti is a small nation, it does have very distinctive regional cultures. And not just that, but also like political and economic differences mean that those experiences are different. And so probably there are big differences in the voodoo, even more than the kind of like rural-urban divide that I've referred to a couple of times. I talked about the role of voodoo in charity and mutual support a little bit in this season. It's definitely something that I could have covered more. There's some good discussion of this in Karen McCarthy Brown's book, Mama Lola, in two ways. Well, actually in many ways, but two ways that stood out for me, two like examples of this. One is, I don't know if it's McCarthy Brown or Brown. I'm going to call her McCarthy Brown. I don't know if McCarthy's her middle name or if it's her last name is McCarthy Brown. You know what I mean? Anyway, it doesn't matter. She's in New York among the Haitian immigrant community. So these are people who have like connections to Haiti, but live in a society where, you know, because they know a lot of other Haitian immigrants, it's not that there's no support network of voodoo, but where that is not widespread into like the society in general. It's surrounded by millions of people who are not voodooisants. And like all immigrant communities, networks of mutual support are important. And so she addresses that in terms of what her informant Allured does in her voodoo practice. But then also, at one point, they go back to Haiti, and during that trip, she attends this ceremony, the Feeding of the Poor. The Feeding of the Poor is part of Haitian voodoo. It's a ceremony that is, like, it's not like some spontaneous act of generosity. It's a, you know, oh, we're going to do a Feeding of the Poor ceremony. Everybody knows what a Feeding of the Poor is. And she really makes a point of it not being, like, it's not this joyous occasion, right? The children who are being fed are not all that thrilled about the whole thing. The menu is dictated by tradition, so it's not exactly like a great meal for them. And they're pretty uncomfortable doing this while being watched by this whole crowd who are attending the ceremony. And it's a ritualized performance of charity, which is only kind of incidentally an actual act of charity, which I thought was interesting. Now this, you know, this of course is just McCarthy Brown's experience of it. And I think it's always difficult to read these kinds of texts because she's involved in this thing and she's observing it. Well, it's not difficult to read, but it's difficult to draw conclusions from it, I guess I should say. Her emotional experience is part of what she's reporting on. And this is an effective participatory thing. So that's necessarily the case, right? It's unavoidable. If it wasn't reflected in her work explicitly, it would still be implicitly. But it's hard to draw any kind of generalizable conclusion from what McCarthy Brown is reporting, because she's kind of reporting the vibes, right? Her book is about Allured and what Allured goes through, and herself and what she goes through, as much as it is about voodoo. So while there were parts of it that were very useful for this season, and while, you know, it's a good book and I recommend it, I think we've seen a lot of sources that are people's individual experiences of voodoo as an insider, or large-scale portraits of the religion from the perspective of an outsider, something like Metro, where he's, you know, an anthropologist. There are fields where if you only want to read one book about something, it exists. So if you wanted to study Norse mythology, but you only wanted to read one book, there are a number of books that I could point you to. You know, whether that's you want to just like read the poetry or whether you want to have like an overview, there are a number of possibilities. They all have their strengths and weaknesses, but they exist. I remember writing to a friend of mine some years ago now and saying, hey, I want to learn more about the Baltic Crusades, but I don't know very much about them. What's the one book on the Baltic Crusades? What's the first book that a beginner should read? And he said, it kind of doesn't exist in English. And maybe that's the case with Haitian voodoo. Another thing I didn't talk about all that much, although I mentioned it, is voodoo and anti-colonialism. You know, voodoo's fusion of European and African influences is inextricably linked to the experience of slavery and colonialism. One event that's often said to be the spark of the Haitian Revolution is the Bois Caiman ceremony, which took place in northern Haiti in 1791, or at least according to legend. Legend's the wrong word, but revolutionary movements trying to escape official notice tend not to keep super detailed records. There are, in fact, historians who say that the Bois Caiman meeting never happened at all, and there are ones who think it did, who don't necessarily agree on what exactly happened, but insofar as we're willing to accept this story, and I don't see why it's not true in outline, but insofar as we're willing to accept this story, it was a meeting of enslaved people from local plantations in that region, coordinating the beginning of an uprising, the uprising that would eventually turn into the Haitian Revolution. And part of that involved a voodoo ritual. We're told that it involved a sacrifice to Esli Danton. I don't know that we actually have that written down so much as they're like, oh, well, they sacrificed this animal and that animal is particularly sacred to Esli, therefore that's probably what it was, right? One of the people who led this voodoo ritual was Dutty Bookman, who became one of the revolutionary leaders and was killed fighting the French later that year. So there was a connection between this religious leader, this Hongan, and the revolution right from the very beginning. And I think you could also argue, certainly there are those who would argue, that voodoo existing at all is essentially an act of anti-colonial resistance, the preservation of elements of African cultures in the face of European Christian dominance. And what's interesting is that it isn't just like preservation of African culture. It isn't keeping your own faith alive in secret, pretending to accept Catholic teaching, but secretly ignoring it. The relationship between voodoo and European culture is much more complicated and interesting than that, because the voodoo relationship with Catholicism is not about accepting or ignoring it, but about adapting and reinterpreting it. So you take the thing that the colonial upper classes are imposing on you, and you don't accept it, and you don't just shrug it off. Instead, you mold it to your own purposes. You add your own meaning to it. You make it yours. And we see this, of course, not just in voodoo, but in all of the religions of the Afro-Caribbean diaspora. And indeed, not only in the Afro-Caribbean diaspora, but in other colonized places. And I mentioned this, but one thing about it that I think we can take away for games is that this isn't something that you see very much in role-playing games, right? And once again, I think this is connected to the idea that is commonplace in RPGs, but rare in the real world, that religion is an exceptional thing, and that therefore it's a bit like kind of not being very religious is seen as the, like, being American of role-playing game characters, if that makes sense. I mentioned before I was watching the movie Stoker, and there's a scene in which there are three people at a dinner table having a conversation, and every person there is faking an American accent. Matthew Good is British, Nicole Kidman's Australian, and Mia Wasikowska's Australian. And the director's Korean. And the film is not noticeably set anywhere. Like, it could be set anywhere. But if in a movie it were set somewhere other than America, it would be about not being in America. Because America's the default, and then not being America is exceptional. See also, why isn't Doctor Strange British? Benedict Cumberbatch's American accent is terrible. And Doctor Strange, to paraphrase Chris Sims, is both a wizard and a snob. Two things that we associate with being British. There's no reason for him not to have an English accent. But if he were British, then being British would be part of his gimmick, because normal people are American. And I see a little bit of the same kind of thinking in the way that religion is presented as exceptional in role-playing games. What I mean is, if a character is religious in an RPG, it is an important part of their deal, as opposed to just like, oh, they go to church on Sundays. And what that means is that characters who are religious in RPGs tend to be religious purists or religious extremists. A lot of the time when games have religious characters, they have these very exaggerated religious sensibilities, and that probably means that they don't get into the kind of adaptive syncretism that is seen in something like Haitian voodoo. The idea of spiritual traditions that are permeable in this way tends to get overlooked. In reality, people take images and ideas from different religious beliefs and they blend them together all the time. We've also seen this, although maybe without the same kind of like element of power dynamic of like a colonialist thing, but we've also seen this with the way that Shinto and Buddhism kind of blended together in several areas in our Japanese season. So, and I think that this is an idea that you could include in a game setting without having to have it specifically be voodoo. So if you were having a fantasy world, you could definitely have the religion of like a captive, colonized, or enslaved community incorporate aspects of their own traditional practices, but also the religious beliefs of their oppressors. And I can't off the top of my head think of too many religious traditions in fantasy worlds that function like this. There are some where the religious tradition has been forced to exist in secret, but I can't think of too many with groups that have actually adapted the beliefs and images of the oppressor. Maybe something for the future. Obligatory Glorantha note, one of the things about the new Glorantha religious books that I think is very interesting is that they take a look at the history of the religions. And in many fantasy worlds, because gods are real and communicate directly with their worshippers, you have religions that are essentially unchanging. Like Kord tells you to be strong or whatever. He doesn't change his mind because he's real and he exists and he has a very simple set of principles and he's willing to communicate them to you. But in Glorantha, even though the gods are real, religions change and their emphasis changes because they are about adapting, well, first understanding the ideals of that deity and then applying them to situations. So as the situation changes, so too do the structures and practices and even to some extent beliefs of the religion, even though it is possible to discern what Orlanth is like. So I thought that was interesting. It does require you to have gods operate the way that they very specifically operate in Glorantha. Orlanth is real, but you cannot just ask him a question, or if you do, it's incredibly difficult. One reason that I felt such trepidation about covering voodoo is, of course, the reputation that it has as this dark religion full of occult practices, and my unwillingness to perpetuate that stereotype. You know, I think I've mentioned before that the edition of Metro that I have is part of the, like, Dennis Wheatley occult library, and it actually begins with an introduction in which Wheatley has to disclaim the fact that the book doesn't really contain all that much black magic, because it is a sober, if perhaps a little outdated, study of Haitian voodoo within its social and philosophical context. So there's a bunch of stuff in the introduction about, you know, how sinister and spooky and bloodthirsty voodoo is. And he's like, yeah, like, I'm sorry that we put like a knife wielding naked guy on the cover of this book, but actually that's not what this book is about. Now, part of this is, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, I didn't go back and check, but I wouldn't be surprised if that introduction actually cites this book, a book that had a lot of influence on the perception of voodoo in the English-speaking world. I mentioned it in a previous episode, and I said I couldn't remember the name of it. Metro was very critical of it, and that is, of course, William Seabrook's book, The Magic Island, which came out in 1929 and was largely responsible for creating the idea of the zombie. That is where the idea that a zombie is an animated corpse comes from. So the idea of the zombie as the animated corpse actually does come from a discussion of Haitian voodoo, even though I don't think that in Haitian voodoo a zombie is understood as an animated corpse. But that is Seabrook's interpretation of the stories and things that he was dealing with. The debate about Seabrook's book makes me want to, because this is one of those things where the majority of modern writers seem to consider Seabrook's work to be a piece of racist imperialist propaganda, offering an exoticized, melodramatic understanding of Haitian culture and faith in an effort to justify the then ongoing U.S. occupation of Haiti. But by contrast, if you look at reviews that the book received around that time, some of them are like, yeah, Seabrook tears the lid off the shocking and perverse practices of voodooism. But also some people consider it to be like a nuanced portrait of the Haitian people that shows ambivalence about U.S. military intervention in the country, and they understand Seabrook to be something of a sympathetic observer. So this may be kind of a James Morton situation. In the August bonus episode, I talked about James Morton's The Curse of Race Prejudice, and talk about like, well, yeah, it's amazing how you can be progressive, not even just by the standards of 1929, but like Morton thinks that racial prejudice is bad, but that still includes a lot of assumptions about race and about the existence of race and all these other things that are not part of the way that we think about those things in the modern day. So in a sense, it's amazing how racist you can be and still be a progressive by the standards of 1929. And this is not unique to voodoo, right? Cultures just do have a tendency to reduce faiths that are not their own to these kinds of stereotypes. Now look at the way in which Buddhism is often portrayed as a kind of like self-help lifestyle thing that doesn't really have any relationship to Buddhism as it is practiced in most of the places where it is practiced. I remember reading someone saying about like Richard Gere or somebody, you know, oh, he's a Buddhist, so you know he's very spiritual. And I was just like, that's an absolutely wild thing to say, right? If somebody said he's a Methodist, so you know he's very spiritual, you'd think they were crazy. But quite apart from the fact that it's like an inaccurate and unrepresentative stereotype, it also gives Haiti this kind of like, ooh, spooky vibe that I think can help people overlook what voodoo actually is, what its role is in Haitian society, and a lot of aspects of actual Haiti in general. And Haiti, as you don't need me to tell you, is a nation that has suffered from a long series of crises, some of them internal, some of them natural in the form of natural disasters, right? Haiti very vulnerable to earthquakes, but some of them externally imposed. And I'm not saying that a portrait of Haiti as a land of magic and mystery causes these crises, but I do think that it can represent a way of avoiding having to think about those crises, right? For a lot of people, voodoo is the one thing they know about Haiti, the one thing they know about Haitian society. And then their stereotype of voodoo informs how they think about Haiti because voodoo is really the only thing they know about Haiti and Haitians. It's always weird how nations that don't have the kind of like externalized media, whatever, you know, that don't have this kind of big presence in other people's lives. Many people in the world think about the United States who don't live there because decisions made in the United States affect their lives. And other countries tend to get reduced to a single stereotype. And when your one stereotype is you're a land of magic and mystery, that's maybe not great. Which is all just a way of saying that this season, like the previous season, and I assume like the future ones, is helping to remind me to be respectful of the huge amount out there that I don't know. You know, you're doing the Norse myth section. First, it's a subject that I have a pretty comfortable knowledge of to begin with. And second, it's a subject where the resources are really pretty readily available to you. Same goes for the Arthurian one, or, you know, even the Shinto one or whatever. Like, those key texts that describe the myths that are covered in these sections are available in English translations. You can get them online, etc., etc. But there are still religious traditions out there that we know so little about, or I know so little about anyway, which is on the one hand daunting, but on the other hand exciting. As I said before, I'm approaching these later seasons as a student. I'm just trying to learn, and I hope that you enjoy learning with me. All right, so that about wraps it up for Haitian voodoo. Now, I haven't decided what our next season is going to be. I'll put up a poll on the Patreon site. In the meantime, we're going to do some fill-in episodes about fictional deities. And the first of those, in response to a question from Patreon backer Andrew, is going to be about the religions of George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire books, which I think, actually, I can't believe we haven't done these before, but represent a particular way of thinking about religious history, which, even though I don't agree that that's how religions work in real life, you can see that it provides a thematically useful, simple way to approach a topic that the author otherwise doesn't particularly care about. So I hope that you will join me then as we talk about it right here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.